My fault when it all falls apart. Shooting him might help. I hope not, Holden said. But he was worried that Amos was right. Interlude. The Investigator. It reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out. 113 times a second. Nothing answers, and it reaches out. It feels no frustration, though parts of it do. It is not designed to incorporate consciousness or will, but to use whatever it finds. The minds within it are insisted, walled off. They are used when they are of use, as is everything, and it reaches out. It is not a plan. It is not even a desire. Or it is only a desire without knowledge of that longing's object. It is a selective pressure pressed against chaos. It does not think of itself this way, because it does not think. But the environment changes. A new branch of possibilities opens, and it forms the investigator, and leans into the new crack, the new space. The minds within it interpret this differently. As a hand reaching up through graveyard soil, as finding a door in a room where no door had been before, as a breath of air to a drowning woman, it is not aware of these images, but awareness of them is part of it. The investigator puts pressure on the aboriginal, and the aboriginal takes action. The environment changes again. Patterns begin to match patterns, but there can be no recognition, because it is not conscious to recognize. It would be aware of the aboriginal accelerating, of its slowing, the vectors shifting zero to one to a different zero in a different location, if it were aware. But it is not aware. It reaches out. Patterns match, and it reorients and reaches out. Cascades of implicit information bloom, and the conscious parts of it see a lotus opening forever, hear a shout that is made of other shouts that are made of other shouts in a fractal constructed of sound, pray to God for a death that does not come. It reaches out, but the ways in which it reaches change. It improvises, as it always has, the insect twitch, the spark closing the gap, it reaches out. It touches something, and for a moment, a part of it that can feel, feels hope. It is unaware of hope. The reply does not come. It is not over. It will never be over. It reaches out and finds new things, old things. It flows into places that are comfortable for it to flow. There are responses, and the responses feed the impulses that cause them, and there are more responses, all automatic and empty and dead as it is. Nothing reaches back. It feels no disappointment. It does not shut down. It reaches out. It does not experience the wariness, but the wariness is part of it. It reaches out, rushing into the new possibility space, and something deep in it, wider than it should be, watches it reach. Doors and corners. It reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out. Doors and corners. This could get ugly, kid. Chapter 12. Baja. James Holden came too late. Along with everyone else in the colony, Baja watched the drive plume of the Rocinante light the sky of Illus. For him, maybe, it was already too late. He'd made the bombs that destroyed the RCE shuttle and killed the UN governor. He'd been there when Coop and the others murdered the RCE security team. And maybe there was no coming back from that. Maybe he was already a dead man. Or a man destined for life in prison. The same thing, really. But looking up the line of white fire in the sky, he couldn't help but feel a spark of hope. Jim Holden had saved the Ganymede children. Too late for Katoa, but he'd saved the others. He'd brought down the evil corporation that had killed Bajie's little boy. Neither Mal Kukowski nor Protogen existed anymore because of Holden. And while Bajie had never met the man in person, he'd watched him on videocasts and read about him in news feeds. It created a strange sense of intimacy to watch the man who'd avenged Katoa on screen, talking and smiling. And that man was coming to Illis. Perhaps he could save Bajie too. So when the bright line in the sky vanished and Bajie knew Holden and his crew were in orbit, he let himself feel a swell of hope, the first he'd felt in a long time. And when he heard the thunderclap of a descending shuttle, he ran outside just like all the other colonists, watching to see where it would land. "The UN mediator is coming," they shouted to each other. "The man who saved Earth," they meant. "The man who saved Ganymede. The man who will save us." A small shuttle dropped out of the sky and settled on the hard-packed Earth to the south of the first landing, and half the town's population ran to meet it. Bajie ran too. The shuttle sat on 5 squat legs, ticking with heat. The town waited in silence, too excited to talk. Then a ramp lowered to the ground, and a squat earther with gray hair and a deeply lined face walked down it. It wasn't Holden. One of his crew, maybe? But the man was wearing armor with the RCE logo on it, and Holden was supposed to be an impartial mediator. The man stopped halfway down the ramp and smiled a humorless smile at them. Bajie realized he was holding his breath, then realized everyone else was too. "Hello," the man said. "My name is Adolphus Murtry. I am chief of security for Royal Charter Energy." Was it another RCE ship they'd seen breaking into orbit? The man walked down the ramp, still smiling that predator's smile, and as one, the crowd backed away. Bajie backed up with them. "Because of the attack on the shuttle that claimed the lives of many RCE employees and UN officials, I am taking direct control of security on this world. If that sounds like martial law, that's because it is." Murtry whistled, and 10 more people in security armor descended the ramp. They carried automatic weapons and slug-throwing sidearms, not a non-lethal deterrent in sight. "Please be aware," Murtry continued, "that because of the attack on the first security team, no one proved they were attacked," someone shouted from the crowd. Coop. It was Coop, standing at the back with his arms crossed and a smug smile on his face. "Because of that attack," Murtry continued, "I have given my people shoot first authorization. They may, if they feel threatened, utilize lethal force to defuse the threat." Carol pushed through the crowd to confront Murtry at the bottom of the ramp, and Coop followed her. "You're not the government here," Carol said, anger making the tendons in her neck stand out. Her hands were in fists, but she kept them at her sides. "You can't just land here with a bunch of guns and tell us you have the right to shoot us. This is our world." "That's right," Coop yelled, and turned to face the crowd, inviting them to join in. "No," Murtry said, his smile not changing. "It is not." The air was split with thunder as another ship dropped into the atmosphere and landed on the western side of town. Murtry barely glanced up at it. More troops dropping in, Bajie thought. Murtry began walking toward town, his people trailing out behind him, and the crowd moving in a loose cloud around them. Carol kept talking, but her words had no effect. Murtry just smiled and nodded and didn't break stride. The ship that had landed on the other side of town blasted off in a column of white vapor and vanished from sight. The roar of its engines filled the world. When they reached the center of town, Bajie saw Jacek hanging around the edge of the crowd. He grabbed his son by the arm, pulling him harder than he intended, and the boy gave a frightened squeak. "Papa," he said as Baja dragged him away. Am I in trouble? Yes, Baja shouted. Then when he saw tears welling up in the boy's eyes, stopped and dropped to his knees next to him. No. No, son, you're not. But I need you to go home. But, Jacek started, no buts, boy. Baja gave him a gentle shove toward their house. Go home. Is that man going to kill us? Jacek asked. What man? Baja asked. But it was a delaying tactic. He knew what man. Even his little boy could smell the death coming off of Murtry and his people. No one's going to kill us. Go home. Baja watched Jacek walk home, waiting until he saw the boy go inside and close the door. Baja was just starting to walk back toward the crowd when the shot rang out. His first thought was, Jacek was right. They are killing us. Not us, though, once he got back to the crowd. Just Coop, lying in the dust with a red hole where his eye should be, blood pooling under his head. And Holden, jaw clenched and eyes wide. Too late, Baja thought. Too late again. People with machine guns walked the streets of First Landing. Baja and Lucia sat on their tiny front porch and watched them pass by in the fading sunlight of early evening. A man and a woman, both in body armor with the red and blue RCE company logo on it, both carrying automatic weapons, both with hard expressions on their faces. I did this, Baja said. Lucia squeezed his hand. Drink your tea, Baj. Baja looked down at the cup of tea cooling on his lap. All the tea the little colony might ever have had come down on the shuttles with them. To waste such a luxury was unthinkable. He sipped at the lukewarm cup and didn't taste it.
They'll kill me next.
Maybe. Or put me in jail forever, take me away from my family. You, Lucia said, took yourself away when you joined with those stupid, violent people who blew up the shuttle. You drove them out to the ruins when they killed the RCE people. You made every choice that took you to this place. I love you, Baja Merton. I love you till my chest aches, but you are a stupid, stupid man. And when they take you away from me, I will not forgive you for it. You're a harsh woman. I'm a doctor, Lucia said. I'm used to giving people bad news. Baja drank off the rest of his tea before it could finish getting cold. I could get some rope or chain from the dig site. Maybe hang a bench here. Then we could rock while we sit. That might be nice, Lucia said. The pair of RCE guards reached the end of the street and turned around to come back. With the sun about to dip below the horizon, their shadows were almost as long as the town itself. We've been focusing on lithium mining to get money, Baja continued, but we need to start thinking about our own energy needs. This is true. We can't have the bar bringing us power cells forever. And someday the ship will fly back to Pallas to sell the ore, so we won't have her for a couple years. Also true, Lucia said. She swirled the last of her tea and stared up at the stars. I miss having Jupiter in the sky. It was beautiful, Baja agreed. I have to go meet with Kate and the others tonight, after it gets dark. Baj, Lucia started, then just stopped with a sad sigh. They'll want revenge for Coop. It will only make it worse. What, Lucia said, does worse look like, I wonder? Baja sat quietly, thinking of the rocker he could build on their porch, of adding a bigger water heater for hot baths, of building a larger kitchen and dining area on the back of the house, of all the things he wouldn't get to do now. The guards were at the end of the town's long street, almost invisible in their dark armor and the fading light. Baja got up to leave. Can you stop them from killing anyone else? Lucia asked, as though she were asking if he wanted more tea. Yes, Baja replied. It felt like a lie. Then go. They met at Kate's house. Pete and Scotty and Ibrahim. Even Zadie came, her wife Amanda staying home to look after their boy and his infected eye. That wasn't a good sign. Of all of them, Zadie was the angriest, the one with the hottest head. Baja had worked with her on Ganymede, and more than once she'd shown up in the morning with a black eye or a busted lip from some bar fight she'd picked the night before. They were all upset, all standing on the ledge about to jump, but Zadie would be the hardest to talk off of it. They shot Coop, Kate said when Scotty, the last of them to arrive, finally came in. It wasn't a statement of fact. They'd all been there. They'd all seen it. No, it was the beginning of a justification. In cold blood, Zadie said, and punctuated it with a fist to her palm. We all saw it. Just shot him in the face in front of God and everyone. So I have a plan, Kate continued. The RCE people are holed up in... Who put you in charge? Zadie asked. Murtry did. Zadie narrowed her eyes but let it drop. Baja fidgeted on one end of Kate's couch. It was a handmade frame, covered with padding stripped from the ship and badly stitched remnants of the cloth they had the fabricator crank out once a month for clothing and other needs. Kate had made a small table out of the local wood analog to sit next to it. It wasn't quite level, and Baja's glass of water was at a noticeable tilt. Pictures of Kate's family, two sisters who still lived back in the belt and their kids, hung on the walls. There was a pottery vase on the floor, with sticks and branches in it that Baja thought was meant as decoration, not kindling. It was too domestic a location for the kind of meeting they were having. It all felt unreal, that he and five people he knew were discussing the murder of a dozen corporate security guards in Kate's living room, next to her vase full of sticks. Scotty was talking, telling them to wait. Not the voice of reason, the voice of fear. Pete was on his side, arguing against escalating. Kate and Zadie shouted them down. Ibrahim said nothing, just pulled on his bottom lip and frowned at the floor. I think we wait for Holden, Baja said when there was a pause in the conversation. Holden's been here a day. What are we waiting for? Kate asked, dripping angry sarcasm. He needs time to meet with us, get the lay of the land, Baja said, the words sounding feeble even in his own ears. But he's the mediator, and he can talk directly to the OPA governing board and to the UN. His recommendations will have real weight. We need him on our side. The OPA, Zadie spat, the UN. What exactly are they going to do for us? Send a tersely worded letter? Murtry and his thugs are right there. Zadie stabbed her fingers at the wall, at the street beyond, at the guards with machine guns. How many of our people do they get to kill before we defend ourselves? We killed them first, Baja said, then regretted it immediately. Everyone started shouting, mostly at him. Baja stood up. He knew he was an imposing figure, stocky and thick-necked, bigger than anyone else in the room. He stepped forward, a physical challenge. He hoped his size would be enough. He was fairly certain Kate could beat him to death if she decided to. Shut up! They did. We have a chance here, he continued, quieting his voice with an effort. But it's so fragile. We killed the RCE people. I wasn't, Zadie started, but Baja hushed her with a gesture. They killed Coop. Right now, they feel like they've made a point, so they won't kill anyone else unless we provoke them. So right now, we are at a balance. If no one does anything to tip it one way or another, Holden can do what they sent him here to do. He can help us resolve this without more violence. Kate snorted and looked away, but Bajia ignored her. I'm in this with you. I have just as much to lose as any of you. But we want this man on our side. He saw Murtry murder one of us. He's never seen us do anything. We have the advantage of seeming like the victims right now. Let's not change his mind on that. There was a long moment while Bajia stood in the middle of the room, panting with emotion, and no one spoke. Okay, Ibrahim said. He'd been a soldier once. The others respected him. When he finally spoke, it was with a tone of authority. Kate frowned but said nothing. Okay? Okay, big man, Ibrahim said. We play it your way for now. Go talk to this Holden. Get him on our side. He's the one found your boy, Sasa. Use that. Bajia felt a rush of anger and shame at the mention of Katoa, of using him as an in with Holden, but he pushed it down. Ibrahim was right. It would give Bajia something to talk to Holden about, and it would make him seem sympathetic. I'll talk to him tomorrow, Bajia said, swallowing the sudden nausea he felt. It's on you now, big man, Ibrahim said. It sounded like a threat. Bajia walked home in the pitch black of the illest night. He wished he'd thought to bring a light. He wished he'd never blown up a shuttle full of people and helped Coop murder the RCE guards. He wished his wife wasn't angry with him, and that she wasn't right. He wished that Katoa were still alive and that they all still lived in their home on Ganymede, and that no one had ever come to Illis in the first place. He tripped on a rock and fell to his knee, skinning it. No way to fix the other things, but at least he could have thought to bring a light. Lucia had left a light on in the house. Without it, Bajia might have walked right past it without realizing. At least she wanted him to come home. She left lights on to make it happen. For the first time in a long time, Bajia felt himself smile. A shadowy figure darted through the dim light around the house to the back door. Before he had time to think, Bajia was at a dead run. The figure at the door cowered, smaller than him and terrified. Felsia. Papa, you scared me. Oh, baby, I'm so sorry. I didn't see it was you. Just saw someone sneaking around the house and came running. Felsia smiled up at him, eyes damp and lip trembling, but being brave. Okay, going in now. Felsia, Bajia said, putting his hand against the door to hold it closed. Why are you sneaking up to the house in the middle of the night? I was out, walking. She looked away, not able to meet his eyes. Please, baby, tell me it was a boy. It was a boy, she said, still not looking at him. Felsia. I'm going up on the next shuttle, Papa, she said, looking him in the eye finally. I'm going up. When James Holden gets them to let the Barba Piccola go, I'm going with it. From Palace, I can catch transport to Ceres. Mama is calling her old mentor at CUMA to give me an interview for the pre-med program at the Hadrian on Luna. Bajia felt like someone had punched him in the solar plexus. The pain in his stomach kept him from breathing. I'm going, Papa. No, he said. You're not. Chapter 13. Elvi. Elvi's grandfather had remarried late in life. His new husband had been a German man with a merry laugh, a snow-white beard, and a cheerful cynicism about humanity. What she remembered best about Grandpa Reynard was how quick he was with an epigram or a quip. He had one for every occasion. She'd thought they made him sound worldly and wise, in part because she was so often unsure what exactly he meant by them. One thing he'd said was, "Once is never, twice is always." When the shuttle went down, she'd known, they'd all known, that someone had put the explosives there. But her experience of the Belter colonists beginning that same night had been so different that the knowledge and the emotional impact of it had become detached. Someone among the Belters had done a terrible thing. But that person was faceless, anonymous, unreal. Dr. Merton, doing everything she could to save the wounded and soothe the injured, was real. Her daughter, Felcia, who was at the farthest point humanity had ever been from Earth, and whose ambitions were drawing her back toward Luna, was real. Anson Kotler and his sister Connie, who'd helped Elvi set up her hut. Samish O, with his goofy half-smile, was real. Carol Chiwiwi, Aaron Sanchez. They had all been so kind that Elvi had shelved the death of the governor as an outlier, something so rare it would never happen again. But the disappearance of Reeve and the security crew was twice, and the way Elvi saw the colony and the RCE scientists and her own little hut out on the edge of the plain was different now. Because the threat of violence wasn't never anymore. It was always.
"Did you see anything else?" Murtry asked.
"No," Elvi said. "I don't think so."
"Dr. Okoye, I know this has been unpleasant for you," the chief of security said, "but I need you to try to remember if there was anything else you saw while you were out there. The person you saw coming back, can you say if it was a man? A woman?"
That wasn't how memory worked, of course. Just willing herself to remember something, pushing herself, was much more likely to generate a false recollection and add bad data to the set than it was to haul up some telling detail she'd failed to mention. It seemed rude to explain that to Murtry, so Elvi only shook her head.
"I'm sorry," she said.
"It's all right," he said in a tone of voice that hinted strongly at his disappointment. "If anything else occurs to you, please do bring it to me."
"I will."
"Are you feeling okay?"
"I guess so. Why?"
"The UN mediators asked to talk with you too," Murtry said. "You don't have to if you don't want, though. Just say the word and I'll tell him to go piss up a rope."
"No, I don't mind," she said. But she was thinking, "James Holden wants to talk to me? Should I mean, is there anything I should particularly tell him? About the work, I mean?" The truth was, she just wanted to get out of the security offices. The extended 30-hour day of New Terra made it hard to feel exactly how long she'd been there. But she'd come to Reeve in darkness. She'd slept in one of the cells that night. She'd stayed there while Murtry and the security team came down and made the town safe. And now it was morning again. So 2 days, New Terra. Maybe 3 back on Earth. What exactly day meant wasn't intuitive anymore.
"Captain Holden needs to understand exactly how bad our situation here is," Murtry said. "He came out here thinking there's 2 sides to this, so he's wanting to split some kind of difference. Anything you can do to help him understand why that's not the solution here, I would very much appreciate."
"Oh," she said, "yes, of course."
"Thank you," Murtry said.
"One thing?"
Murtry raised his eyebrows and tilted his head toward her. He didn't quite say, "Yes, ma'am," but it was physically implied.
"My research is still in my hut," she said. "I have some studies that were in progress when I came to talk to... when I came in. Is my hut off limits, or will I be able to get back to them?"
"You'll go back," Murtry said. "The one thing that is not going to happen here, Doctor, we're not giving back a goddamn centimeter of our ground. Whoever did this doesn't get to win."
"Thank you," Elvi said.
Murtry's expression hardened for a moment. His eyes became flat, in a way that Elvi associated with lab animals being sacrificed. He looked dead.
"You're welcome," he said.
Walking down the street of the town,
Elvie felt a pang of unease, but less so than she'd expected. The little siege she'd suffered in the security office waiting for the relief team to come had been a bleak and frightening time. But now, familiar faces had joined the townsmen. Two women in RCE security armor walked down the street across from her, their assault rifles resting easily in their hands. Just seeing them there left Elvie feeling safer. And then Holden had also arrived. Certainly, things weren't where they needed to be, but they were getting closer. They were getting better. That would have to be enough for now. Another guard stood at the entrance to the general store, a rifle resting in his hands. "Dr. Okoye," he said, nodding her inside. "Mr. Smith," she said. She'd been in the commissary building many times in the weeks since she'd landed on New Terra. Apart from little intimate get-togethers in the research huts and the formal town meetings in the community hall, it was the only place to go unless she found religion. She could see, feel at once, how the presence of James Holden had changed the nature of the space. It had been a community place before, public in the same way a municipal park might be, without any commanding human presence. Now, a man sat at a table toward the back of the room, just as if he were a townsman getting a bowl of rice and a beer. Sitting there, leaning on his elbows and talking to Faez, he commanded the space. He owned it. What had belonged to everyone was now the unquestioned domain of James Holden. Elvie's belly went a little tighter, and anxiety spared her breath. She had seen Holden on the news feeds and reports. At the beginning of the war between Mars and the Belt, he had been the most important man in the solar system. And the celebrity, while it had waxed and waned over the years, had never gone away. James Holden was an icon. For some, he was the symbol of the triumph of the single ship over governments and corporations. For others, he was an agent of chaos, who started wars and threatened stability in the name of ideological purity. But whatever people thought he meant, there was no question that he was important. He was the man who'd saved Earth from the proto-molecule. He was the man who'd brought down Mao Kukowski, who'd made the first contact with the alien artifact and opened the gates that led to 1,000 different worlds. In person, he looked different than his image on the screen. His face was still broad, but not as much so. His skin had a warmth that even years in the sunless box of a ship couldn't erase. The dark brown hair had a dusting of gray at the temples, but his eyes were the same sapphire blue. As she watched, Holden rubbed a hand across his chin, nodding at something that Faez was saying. It was an unconsciously masculine movement that left Elvie thinking of large animals, lions, gorillas, bears. There was no sense of threat in it, only of power. And she was profoundly aware that the man she had seen only as an image on a data feed was exhaling the same molecules that she was breathing in.
"You okay?"
Elvie started. The man who'd asked was huge, pale, and muscular. His shaved head and thick belly made him look like a gigantic baby. He put a hand on her shoulder as if to steady her. "Fine," she said, her inflection making it a question.
"You just looked a little weird there for a second. You sure you're feeling all right?"
"I was supposed to meet with Captain Holden," she said, trying to pull herself back together. "My name's Elvie Okoye, and I'm with the RCE. I'm an exobiologist with RCE."
"Elvie," Faez called, waving her over.
She nodded to the pale man and walked over to the table where Faez and Holden were sitting. James Holden's eyes were on her.
"This is Elvie," Faez said. "We've known each other since Upper University."
"How do you do?" Elvie said, her voice sounding false and tinny in her ears. She cleared her throat.
"Pleased to meet you," Holden said, rising to his feet and extending a hand.
Elvie shook it, just as if she were meeting anyone else. She was proud of herself for that.
"Sit,"
Faez said, pushing out a chair for her. I was just talking to the captain here about the resources problem.
It's not an issue yet, Elvie said, but it will be.
Holden sighed, clasping his fingers together. I'm still hoping that we can negotiate something that's equitable for everyone involved.
Elvie frowned and tilted her head. How would you do that?
Holden lifted his eyebrows.
Faez leaned in toward her.
We were talking about resources like lithium and money, he said, then turned toward Holden again. She was talking about water and nutrients. Different contexts.
Is there not enough water? Holden asked.
There is, Elvie said, hoping that her blush didn't show.
Of course they were talking about lithium mines. She should have known that.
I mean, there's enough water and nutrients, but that's sort of the problem. We're here in the middle of a totally foreign biosphere. Everything about the place is different from what we're used to dealing with. I mean, it looks like life here is genuinely bichiral.
Really? Holden said.
No one knows what that means, Elvie, Faez said.
Holden politely pretended not to have heard him.
But the animals and insects here all look, well, they don't look familiar, but they've got eyes and things.
They're under the same selection pressures, Elvie said. Some things are just a good idea. Back on Earth, eyes evolved 4 or 5 different times. Powered flight at least 3 times. Most animals put the mouth near the sense organs. The degree of large-scale morphological similarities, given the underlying biochemical differences, is part of what makes this such an amazing research opportunity. The data I've been able to send back since we got here would be enough to fuel research for a generation, and I've barely scratched the surface.
And the resources problem? Holden said. What are the resources you need?
It's not the ones we need, Elvie said, waving her hands. It's the ones we are. From the perspective of the local environment, we're bubbles of water, ions, and high-energy molecules. We're not exactly the flavor that's around here. But it's only a matter of time before something figures out a way to exploit those.
Like a virus? Holden asked.
Viruses are a lot more like us than what we're seeing here, Elvie said. Viruses have nucleic acids. RNA. They evolved with us. When something here figures out how to access us as resources, it's probably going to be more like mining.
Holden's expression was dismayed.
Mining, he echoed. We have an advantage for the time being because we're an older biosphere. From what we can tell, things weren't really evolving here until sometime between 1.5 and 2 billion years ago. We've got pretty strong evidence that we have a good billion-year head start on these guys, at least. And some of our strategies may work against them. If we can build antibodies against the proteins that the locals use, we might be able to fight them off like any other infection.
Or we may not, Faez said.
Part of the reason I came out here, part of the reason I agreed to this, was that we were going to do it right, Elvie said. Hearing the stress coming into her voice. We were going to get a sealed environment, a dome. We were going to survey the planet and learn from it and be responsible about how we treated it. The RCE sent scientists. They sent researchers. Do you know how many of us have sustainability and conservation certifications? 5/6. 5/6. Her voice was louder now than she'd meant it to be. Her gestures were wider, and there was a tremble of outrage in her words. Holden's unreal blue eyes were on her, and she could feel him listening like his attention could radiate. Intellectually, she knew what was happening. She was scared, and she was hurt, and she was guilty for having been the one to lead Reeve and the others into danger. She'd been able to ignore it all, but it was bubbling up. She was talking about the biology and the science, but what she meant was, help me. It's all going wrong and no one can help me. No one but you. Only when you got here, there was already a colony, Holden said. His voice was like warm flannel. And a colony made up of a bunch of people who have a lot of very good reasons to distrust corporations and governments. It looks calm here, Elvis said. It looks beautiful, and it is. And it's going to teach us things we never dreamed before. But we're doing it wrong. Faez sighed.
She's right, he said. I mean, I like talking about lithium and moral rights and legalities as much as the next guy, but Elvi's not wrong about how weird this place is when we start looking close enough. And it's got a lot of very dangerous edges that we're not paying any attention to. Because we're, you know, killing each other.
I hear what you're saying, Holden said. I'm going to need to look at it. The part where people are killing each other has to be my first focus, but I promise you that I will put creating a closed, safe planetary dome on the list as soon as we've got the crisis under control, no matter who winds up being in control.
Thank you, Elvi said.
Most of the people here are good, Faez said. The Belters? We've been here for months, and I swear most of these people aren't monsters. They're just poor bastards who thought starting over was a good idea. And Royal Charter is a very, very responsible corporation. Look at their history, and you won't find any more graft and corruption than an average PTA. They're really trying to do all this right.
I know, Holden said. And I wish to hell that made it easier.
Captain? The huge baby man said.
Amos?
There's another mess of legal crap just came through from the UN for you.
Holden sighed.
Am I supposed to read it?
Don't see how they can make you, Amos said. Just thought you'd want to ignore it intentionally.
Thank you, sort of, Holden said. Then turned back to them.
I'm afraid I have to deal with bureaucracy for a while, but thank you both very much for coming. Please always feel free to come talk to me.
Faez stood, and Elvi followed half a second later. He shook each of their hands in turn, then retreated to a room in the back. Faez walked out to the street with her. Hassan Smith and his rifle acknowledged them again as they passed by. The sun glowed in the oxygen-blued sky. She knew it was a little too small, the spectrum of light from it a little slanted toward the orange, but it was familiar to her now. As right as 30-hour days and her close, familiar hut. Faez fell into step beside her.
Heading back to your place? He asked.
I should, she said. I haven't been out since I came to see Reeve. I'm sure all my datasets are finished. I probably have a bunch of angry messages from home.
Yeah, probably, he said.
So, are you all right?
You're the third person to ask me that today, Elvi said. Am I acting like there's something wrong with me?
A little, Faez said. You've got a right to being a little freaked out.
I'm fine, Elvi said.
Her hand still tingled a little where Holden had held it. She massaged her skin. At the end of the street, a Belter girl was walking fast with her head down and her hands shoved deep in her pockets. Murtry and Chandra Wei stood behind her, watching her suspiciously, their rifles in their hands. The wind coming off the plane lifted swirls of dust in the corners of the alleys. She wanted to go back to her hut, and she didn't. She wanted to go back up the well, onto the Edward Israel, and home again. And she wouldn't have left New Terra for all the money in the world. She remembered being very, very young, and terribly upset about something, crying into her mother's shoulder that she wanted to go home, except that she was home when she said it. That was what she wanted now.
Don't do it, Faez said.
Don't do what?
Fall in love with Holden?
I don't know what you're talking about, she snapped.
In that case, really don't do it, Faez said with a cynical laugh, and turned away.
Chapter 14. Holden. This is the first colonial arbitration meeting, Holden said, looking into the camera at the end of the table. My name is James Holden. Representing the colony of New Terra, Illis, Carol said, is Carol Chiwiwi, colony administrator. Representing Royal Charter Energy is Chief of Security Adolphus Murtry. How exactly did that happen? Carol said. She stared at Murtry when she said it, her expression unreadable. Holden had a feeling Carol might be a very good poker player. Murtry smiled back at her. His face was equally unreadable. What's that? You know exactly what I mean, Carol snapped back. What are you doing here? You're hired security. You have no authority to— You put me in this room, Murtry said. When you killed the colonial governor, you do remember that. Big explosion, crashing ship. It would have been hard to miss. Holden sighed and leaned back in his uncomfortable chair. He would let the two of them bicker a bit, release some of the venom they'd been storing up, then put his foot down and drag the discussions back on topic. RCE had offered to host the talks on their shuttle or the Edward Israel, which would have been a lot more comfortable. But the colony had demanded that the meeting be held in First Landing, which meant that instead of contour-fitted, gel-filled chairs, they were sitting on whatever metal and plastic monstrosities the colony had lying around. The table was a sheet of epoxied carbon weave, sitting on four metal legs, and the room they were using was barely large enough for the table and three chairs. A small shelf on one wall held a coffee pot that was hissing to itself and throwing a bitter, scorched smell into the air. Amos leaned against the room's one door, arms crossed, with an expression so far beyond bored that he might actually have been asleep. Endless accusations without evidence to bolster your own criminal claims of property rights, Carol was saying. Enough, Holden cut in. No more outbursts from either of you. I'm here at the request of the UN and OPA to broker some sort of agreement that can let RCE do the scientific work they're authorized to do, and to keep the people already living on New Terra, Illis, from being harmed in the process. What about RCE employees? Murtry asked softly. Are they allowed to be harmed? No, Holden said. No, they are not. And so the mandate of these meetings has changed somewhat in the light of recent events. I've only seen one person murdered since Holden arrived, and that one is on you, Carol said to Murtry. Madam Coordinator, Holden continued, there can be no further attacks on the RCE personnel. That's non-negotiable. We can't work out any sort of deal here unless everyone knows they're safe. But he and you, Holden continued, pointing at Murtry, are a murderer, and one I intend to see prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. You have no— Once we return to a region of space that actually has laws, Holden said. Which brings us to our first real discussion point. There are two competing claims regarding who has the right to administrate this expedition. We have to establish who makes the laws here. Murtry said nothing, but pulled a flexible display out of his coat and unrolled it on the table. It began slowly scrolling through the text of the UN Charter, giving RCE the scientific mission on New Terra. Carol snorted and pushed it back across the table at him. Yes, Holden said. RCE has a legal mandate from the UN placing them in control of this planet for the duration of their scientific mission. But we can't ignore the fact that people had been living on New Terra, or Illis, for months before that charter was drafted. No, we can't, Carol said. So we work out a compromise, Holden said, that allows RCE to do the work they came here to do. Work which will, we hope, benefit everyone, including the colonists. This is a new world. There may be any number of dangers here we are unaware of, but this compromise must also allow for the possibility that the final decision of the home governments will be to grant Illis self-governing status.
Amos snorted, and his head jerked up, eyes wide open for a moment and then slowly narrowing back toward closed.
Yeah, so, Holden said, that's the long, boring explanation. The short version is, I want RCE to move forward with doing the science, and I want the colonists to continue living their lives. And I don't want anyone getting killed. How do we make that happen?
Murtry tilted his chair back on two legs and stretched out with his hands behind his head.
Well, he said, you make a big point of telling me you plan to arrest me once we get back in civilized space.
Yes.
But by my count, the colonists, he sneered the word, have racked up about 24 kills.
And when we figure out who the perpetrators are, Holden said, they too will go back to Sol System to face trials.
You're a detective now, Murtry snorted.
Holden felt a weird chill run down his spine and looked around as if Miller might somehow have appeared.
I think that the RCE Security Force, working in conjunction with Mr. Burton and myself, should continue its investigation of those crimes.
Wait, Carol said, leaning forward suddenly in her chair.
I won't let him investigation only. No trials can be held here, so no penalties can be meted out beyond protective detention. And that only with my express consent.
Your express consent? Murtry said, speaking slowly like he was tasting the words. He smiled.
If they'll let my team keep looking into the killings while we continue the negotiations here, permit us the right to protect ourselves, and guarantee that anyone with strong evidence against them will be held against future trial, I'm fine with that.
Of course he is, Carol said. Delay is all he needs to kill us. Holden frowned at that.
Explain.
We're not self-supporting yet, Carol said. We've got the Barb up in orbit. She can bring us fuel cells charged from her drive, and she dropped us with all the food and seeds she had, but we can't really plant here yet. Soil has the wrong microorganisms in it. We desperately need food stores, soil enrichments, medical supplies.
All of which RCE is happy to, Murtry started. But what we do have is the richest lithium vein any of us have ever seen. And with that ore, we can buy everything else we need. The Israel is keeping the Barb at Picola from sending down her shuttle to pick up the rest, and she's threatened to stop the Barb if she tries to leave orbit.
The mineral rights on New Terra are not yours, Murtry said. Not until the UN says they are.
Carol slapped the table with her palm. It was as loud as a gunshot in the small room.
See? It's a waiting game. If he can just block us from taking our ore up to the ship long enough, then it won't matter who gets those rights. Even if they're awarded to us, we'll be so behind in moving the ore to the ship that we'll all starve to death before we ever get to market.
So, Holden said, you're asking for the right to keep loading the ore onto the Barba Picola while the rights are negotiated.
Carol opened her mouth, closed it, and folded her arms.
Yes, she said.
Okay, Holden said with a nod.
Sounds fair to me.
No matter who winds up selling that ore, they'll need a transport to move it, and the Barb is as good as anything else.
Murtry shrugged.
Fine. We'll allow the shuttle to land and begin transporting ore again, but mining operations come with some problems for me.
Explain, Holden said again.
They're using explosives. The same type of explosive that was used to bring down the shuttle and kill the governor. As long as these people have unrestricted access to it, my people are at risk.
What's your solution? Holden asked.
I want to control access.
So you'll let us move the ore, you won't let us mine, Carol said.
Typical corporate doublespeak.
I'm not saying that, Murtry said, patting the air in a calm-down gesture that struck Holden as intentionally patronizing.
I'm saying we hold the explosives when not in use, and your mining crews sign them out when needed. That way nothing goes missing and shows up later as a pipe bomb. Carol, does that seem fair to you? Holden asked.
It'll slow the process down, but it's not a deal-breaker, she replied.
Okay, Holden said, standing up. We'll stop there for now. We'll meet again tomorrow to go over the UN proposal on colony administration and start hammering out details. We also need to talk about environmental controls.
The OPA,
Carol started. Yes, I have the recommendations from Fred Johnson as well, and those will be discussed. I'd like to transmit a revised plan to the UN and OPA by the end of the week and get their feedback. Acceptable? There were nods from both Murtry and Carol.
Great. I'll want you two with me when I present today's agreement at the town hall meeting tonight. Our first show of goodwill and solidarity.
Murtry rose and walked past Carol without looking at her or shaking hands. Goodwill and solidarity indeed.
So, Amos said when Holden exited the town hall meeting that night. How'd it go?
I must have done it right, Holden replied. Everyone's pissed.
They walked along the dusty street together in companionable silence for a while. Amos finally said,
Weird planet. Walking in open air at night with no moon is breaking my head.
I hear you. My brain keeps trying to find Orion and the Big Dipper. What's weirder is that I keep finding them.
That ain't them, Amos said.
Oh, I know. But it's like my eyes are forcing those patterns on stars that aren't really lined up the right way to make them.
There was another moment of silence, then Amos said,
That's like one of them metaphors, right?
It is now.
Buy you a beer?
Amos said when they reached the doors of the commissary.
Later, maybe. I think I'm going to take a walk. The night air is nice here. Reminds me of Montana.
Okay, see you when I see you.
Try not to get shot or abducted or anything.
I'll do my best.
Holden walked slowly, the dirt of the planet puffing up around his ankles at every stride. The buildings glowed in the darkness. The only human habitation on the planet. The only civilization in the wilds. He put his back to it and kept on going. He was far enough outside the town that he could no longer see its dim lights when a faint blue glow appeared beside him. The glow was both there and not there. It lit the air around it while also illuminating nothing.
Miller? Holden said without looking.
Hey, kid.
We need to talk.
Holden finished for him.
That's less funny the more you do it, the detective said, his hands in his pockets.
Did you come out here to find me?
I admit I'm a little flattered, considering your other problems.
Other problems?
Yeah. That shanty town full of future corpses you're trying to treat like grown-ups.
No way, that doesn't end bloody.
Holden turned to look at Miller, frowning. Is that the former cop talking, or the creepy protomolecule skin doll?
I don't know.
Both, Miller said.
You want a shadow, you gotta have light and something to get in its way.
Can I borrow the cop for a minute?
The gray, jowly man hoisted his eyebrows just the way he had in life.
Are you asking me to use your brain to make these monkeys stop killing each other over rare dirt?
No, Holden sighed. Just advice.
Okay, sure. Murtry is a psycho who's finally in a spot where he can do the creepy shit he's been dreaming about all his life. I just have Amos shoot him.
Carol and her gang of dirt farmers are only alive because they're too desperate to realize how stupid they are. They'll probably die of starvation and bacterial infections in a year, 18 months tops. Your pals, Avasarala and Johnson, have handed you the bloody knife, and you think it's because they trust you.
You know what I hate about you?
My hat?
That too, Holden said. But mostly, it's that I hate everything you say,
but you're not always wrong. Miller nodded and stared up at the night sky.